3.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Incorporate in Bermuda and save millions in taxes. That's the advice being given to many American corporations today by U.S. accountants and lawyers. And that's exactly what Stanley Works and a host of other U.S. corporations are doing. Critics say it's an accounting gimmick designed to let U.S. companies avoid paying taxes while keeping all the benefits of doing business in the United States. Proponents say skipping out on the IRS is just good business. Less tax paid, more money for shareholders. In this hour, the hot trend, American corporations moving the tax address offshore. We begin tonight in Washington, where a high-stakes game of connect the dots is slowly playing out. On Capitol Hill, lawmakers renewed their calls for a thorough investigation of why intelligence agencies failed to piece together information that might have been used to anticipate the 9/11 terrorist attacks. The White House today finds itself on the defensive again after new revelations that the Bush administration had prior knowledge that Osama bin Laden was seeking to hijack planes. Bob Drogan of the Los Angeles Times has been following the latest developments. Earlier, I asked what the White House knew.
What the CIA says it told the White House was that as part of the toolbox that terrorists have used, especially al-Qaeda terrorists, in the past have been a variety of means, including hijacking airplanes. They obviously have used truck bombs against our embassies. They sent a rubber dinghy filled with explosives to try and sink the destroyer Cole in Yemen. And they have hijacked aircraft in India and various other places.
So, Bob Drogan, you're saying that the gist of the president's briefing was not that we are concerned about the potential for an upcoming hijacking in particular, but that al-Qaeda is active and it could do one of the things that it's done before?
As they have explained it, the White House and the CIA have explained it, there was an enormous amount of intelligence coming in last year, especially during the summer months, that raised concerns that al-Qaeda was going to launch an attack on U.S. interests, either at home or abroad. The intelligence led them to evacuate the Fifth Fleet from Bahrain in July, as I recall. Various other attacks were warned about. And in that context, they said that among the things they were concerned about was hijacking of aircraft. They have made it fairly clear that they did not have specific intelligence, and they did not cross anyone's mind that al-Qaeda was considering, was plotting at that very moment to use suicide hijackers and turn aircraft into guided missiles and smash them into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon.
Bob, do you have a sense of how this kind of information would be delivered? Might this have been one fact in a stream of 20 items in a morning briefing or a more singular presentation? Any idea?
Well, the President's Daily Brief is a highly classified newspaper, probably the smallest circulation and highest profile newspaper in the world. It's an oral and a written presentation. It's usually delivered by, at least in this administration, by the Director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, who goes over to the White House early every morning to present it directly to the president. Apparently, they give what they call a threat index or threat matrix of the various threats that they have come across in the previous 24 hours or updates on operations and that kind of thing. They don't make any of that public, so we don't really know what else was said at that particular briefing, simply that it was delivered, given to Bush in the first week of August last year while he was on vacation down at his ranch in Crawford, Texas.
Given that the president had heard this in the morning briefing, and given the subsequent revelations that we're now aware of FBI reports on Middle Eastern men in Phoenix and early indications of interest in Zakaria Moussaoui and so on, is the president likely to have felt let down by security agencies that this wasn't knitted together for him?
Tom, what's happening now is this latest revelation of a CIA warning to Bush about the possibility of a hijacked aircraft coming on top of various accounts in the last several weeks about lapses at the FBI especially have raised a lot of concern among members of Congress that more could have been done and should have been done by the intelligence agencies, by the law enforcement agencies, by the aviation authorities, and clearly by the White House to avert the September 11 tragedy. What people are saying now, look, there are a lot of dots out there. How come no one connected it back then? Whether it's fair to say they should have been able to, or whether the dots were in fact that clear is, you know, remains to be seen.
On Capitol Hill, do you think this will fall mainly into the realm of recrimination, or are we laying the groundwork for more reforms in the American security services here?
The Senate and House Intelligence Committees already had begun an investigation into what the CIA knew, when they knew it, and how they should have done it better. That investigation had stalled as of several weeks ago. Hearings that were originally planned for April were pushed back to May. Now we're told they may come in June. What this latest event has done has really pushed the issue up into the forefront. Ari Fleischer, the president's spokesman, was really hammered today at a press briefing about this. Tom Daschle has spoken out against it. Dick Ephart, the House Minority Leader, is very public today in criticizing this. So it has entered the realm of the political world, and you could argue has given critics some fresh ground, some fresh ammunition to look at what was done and what might have been done to prevent those attacks. So it, arguably, however serious the warning was, it's having a much broader impact right now.
And is there a sense in Washington that basically all the information is now out there, or might there be more revelations to come, or does the government seem to have made a clean breast of what it knew at this point?
Well, I mean, it took 8 months for this story to come out, and the White House only acknowledged it when CBS broke it last night. When I called the CIA to ask about it, they didn't seem to know at that point anything about the warning. So, you know, we don't know what else might be out there. We don't know what we don't know. The committees that are investigating it are talking about asking for copies of the president's briefing materials. They're asking for far more materials from the law enforcement and from the intelligence agencies. Senator Joe Lieberman and McCain are calling for the creation of a citizens commission to look into the failures that led to this. You know, there's a history of all of this. Certainly the Pearl Harbor case, Pearl Harbor attack, and various other incidents in the U.S. past have engendered or spawned various investigations that often have gone on for years and years. This one so far has not led to that kind of public outcry, but we might be getting there.
Bob Drogon, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Bob Drogon covers intelligence for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke to us from Washington. Just last week, Stanley Works, a longtime Connecticut-based tool company, held a vote on moving its corporate headquarters to Bermuda. Although challenged by Connecticut officials, the move is legal and would allow the company to avoid paying a bundle of taxes. American corporations are increasingly looking offshore for tax havens to avoid the full bite of the IRS. What's going on here? How is it that American companies are allowed to take a slide on their taxes? Is corporate patriotism dead, or are U.S. corporate taxes just too high? What do American companies owe America? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Rochester, New York, is David K. Johnston, reporter for the New York Times, who's been covering the offshore migration. Good evening and welcome, David K. Johnston.
Welcome, Tom. Thank you.
Good to have you. And joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
David K. Johnston, take us into this migration that seems to be gaining volume every week. What's going on? Why are American companies increasingly going offshore? And what's the lure?
Well, a handful of companies have done this in years past. Helen of Troy Cosmetics was the first, probably in 1992. The specific technique being used now, which is to go be a Bermuda company resident in Barbados to take advantage of a tax treaty we have with Barbados.
Okay, and the advantage is?
The advantage is that you can take profits you earn in the United States and turn them into tax-deductible expenses when you take your capital out of the United States via Barbados in the form of interest payments to your new corporate parent in Bermuda, royalties for the use of intellectual property like the logo that Stanley puts on every tool they make, and management and overhead fees to pay the parent in Bermuda to supervise the child corporation in the United States.
So the Barbados
piece is the triple axel here, but the basic first move is going to Bermuda. Bermuda has no income tax, and American companies there then avoid paying what taxes?
Well, if you simply go to Bermuda, you avoid paying U.S. taxes on any untaxed profits or taxed lower than U.S. rates elsewhere in the world.
Okay, you're still paying taxes on profits made in the United States, but not on taxes or profits made outside the U.S.
That's right. The United States government taxes both citizens and corporations on their worldwide income.
What kind of tax savings are American corporations realizing through this move?
Well, Ingersoll Rand, which is a manufacturer of machinery, industrial products primarily.
These are the ones whose jackhammers famously helped chisel Mount Rushmore.
Correct.
And now?
They say that they will save $40 million a year worldwide in taxes in return for paying the government of Bermuda $26,000 a year for the next 15 years.
In business terms, that sounds pretty good. Tyco International, another big savings?
Tyco saves, about $450 million a year by being a Bermuda company.
We've seen figures that overall the U.S. Treasury may be missing out on $70 billion plus a year to this. Is that roughly accurate? Do we have any idea?
That's a figure that deals with tax evasion by individual Americans.
Okay.
There are indications that perhaps as many as 2 million credit card accounts are held by Americans in Caribbean countries that have bank secrecy laws. You then tap your money by paying for everything with your credit card and therefore able to spend the money here in the U.S. while evading taxes.
So that's the personal side. But on the corporate side, what does the loss to the U.S. Treasury seem to be from this?
I don't think that we have an accurate number yet. It's a small number of companies, so we're talking at the most right now, if all of the companies that are in the pipeline that we know of do it, about perhaps a couple billion dollars a year at the outside.
But
you have to remember that because of the way this is organized, over time, you reduce increasingly the profits you earn in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
You take your profits offshore so that when Ingersoll Rand says $40 million, when Stanley Works says $30, that's in the beginning. Ultimately, the numbers should reduce their U.S. tax liabilities down close to zero.
You've quoted a partner at Ernst & Young, the big accounting firm, saying this is a mega trend that we see in the marketplace now, and it is clear that lawyers and attorneys are encouraging companies to do this.
Well, if you look at this solely from the point of view of the return you want as an investor, then it makes sense for companies to do this, and companies have been in a position to be able to do this for about 20 years since we made some tax treaty changes in the 1980s when we still had the Cold War going on with the old Soviet Empire.
We're going to get into those, but I want to bring Jack Beattie into the conversation first. Jack, American companies going overseas and cutting their tax bills. Good business?
It sounds like it, but, you know, I've got a modest suggestion. They don't want to pay taxes. Well, perhaps they should do without the things taxes pay for. For example, on Stanley, let Osama bin Laden have a one-off free strike at the offices. I mean, after all, the defense budget is protecting them. And suspend the interstate highway system around there. You know, I mean, why should they get the benefits of those roads since they don't want to pay for them? You could empty the minds of the executives of all they learned in public schools, a process that seems already pretty far advanced. You could reintroduce whooping cough, rubella, smallpox, cholera, other diseases that would be rife in the absence of government actions. Heck, you could even summon the Wampanoosuc Indians back from historical oblivion and give them an encore of scalping and flaying at Stanley Inc. Corporate greed is what Senator Grassley calls it, and I think it's well named. And according to today's New York Times, the Republicans in the House of Representatives are blocking a measure that would prevent this kind of thing.
Jack Beattie, it sounds like you're mad as hell and you're not going to take it anymore.
Yeah, you know, this is like fish in the barrel, but this is a part of a long-standing trend here of corporations drifting away from the countries that harbor them, and it's part of what globalization means.
And yet, of course, that there's the argument is on the other side that American corporate taxes are too hi, David K. Johnston, Jack Beattie, standby. We're going to talk a lot tonight about U.S. companies ducking U.S. taxes offshore. The Bermuda Gang is an American corporation that moves its tax address to Bermuda, mooching off the nation. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Bermuda gang, U.S. companies ducking U.S. taxes offshore. And the question is, in a globalizing world, do corporations have an obligation to chip into the tax pot of any nation? Should patriotism play a role in corporate planning, or is the whole idea of taxing corporations outdated? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by New York Times reporter David K. Johnston, who's been following this emerging trend of companies following tax breaks offshore, setting up a mailbox in Bermuda, and suddenly they're a Bermuda company for tax purposes. Jack Beatty's with us, and now we're joined by Peter Bombush. He's partner at Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher. He's done a lot of work in international taxation. Good evening and welcome, Peter Bombush.
A pleasure to be here tonight.
Thanks for being with us. Peter, explain to us, as you might to a corporate client, the advantages of going offshore in this way, and do you see corporations thinking twice about it?
Well, absolutely. Obviously, and to answer your second question, we've seen some companies do this, but there's a dog that hasn't barked. The vast majority of companies have not done this, in part because in order to accomplish the transaction that has been done by Ingersoll Rand and some of the others, you have to start with paying a tax when you do this restructuring, and the shareholders of those companies owe taxes. Indeed, that's one of the complaints that some of the shareholders of the Stanley Works company have had, is that in order for the company to reduce its taxes, they have to pay tax.
But in a down market, a lot of those taxes, as I understand it, have been overwhelmed by those capital gains, technically, have been overwhelmed by capital losses, making it easier for companies to pull off the maneuver.
Well, certainly that's true. I was just making the point that we haven't seen, we may see later, but we haven't seen a huge rush of everyone to do this. But let me go to your basic point about how this works. Why are people doing this? And in order to understand it, you have to think a little like a tax lawyer. You have to be able to imagine boxes.
We'll try this now. We're going to try it.
Okay. Now, assume that we have one box, which is a U.S. corporation. It does business only in the U.S. It has employees in the U.S. and earns all its income in the United States. It pays U.S. tax on all that income, and that's never going to change. So, for example, if Stanley Works continues to do business, the extent it's doing business in the United States, it will owe U.S. taxes on that business and will pay that tax. Now, by the way, David K. Johnston talked about some ways to reduce those U.S. taxes. I'll have to come back to that in a minute. Mm-hmm. But the principle is U.S. corporation doing business in the United States will owe U.S. tax. Assume there's another box off to the side. It's an Irish corporation. And it does business only in Ireland and pays taxes only in Ireland.
Okay.
And it will be paying presumably at a 20% rate, which is the Irish tax rate.
Lower than the U.S. rate.
And the U.S. rate's 35%.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And so it's benefited. And if the U.S. company goes to do business in Ireland, it's competing against that Irish company, it will, in a sense, be at a competitive disadvantage because it has to pay taxes at a higher rate.
So far you're describing a situation of global competition around tax rates, but where does that take us in terms of developing an offshore tax address?
You're absolutely right. The next step is, if those two companies were separate companies, we understand the competitive problem. Now let's assume that both of those companies are owned by a holding company. So there's another box on top of the two boxes.
Okay, you're testing our outer limits here now.
Yeah, I know I am. It's like an apex of a triangle.
Okay.
That word too
yeah,
much?
We got it.
All right. So in any event, if the top box, the holding company box, is headquartered in the United States, what happens is that the U.S. company subsidiary, one of the bottom boxes,
yes,
it pays U.S. tax, then it pays a dividend up to its parent corporation, which pays a dividend to its shareholders. That income is all taxed at 35%. The Irish company, the Irish subsidiary, it, remember, is paying tax in Ireland at 20%.
Mm-hmm.
But now its shareholders, who are the shareholders of the parent company, want to receive some of those profits. In order for those profits to get to those shareholders, the money has to go through the holding company.
And that means U.S. taxation.
Exactly. Exactly. So
well, okay, we've got that elaborate picture, but I want to put a question into David K. Johnston. Is, in fact, this the typical profile, David K. Johnston? Aren't there simpler companies with more simple structures who are also looking for savings offshore?
Well, Peter's trying to illustrate the fact that you operate in a global environment, and if you're a U.S. company competing with other places, that's a legitimate concern for you because we do now have a global economy and companies look at their global tax rates.
Does that mean that U.S. companies cannot be competitive if they're based in the U.S.?
Not necessarily at all, and that's a very important point. In fact, U.S. companies, first of all, get a credit for the taxes they pay in other countries. Many countries where U.S. companies operate have higher tax rates than the U.S. And on the other side of the coin, there are countries out there that will, for all practical purposes, pay you rather than tax you to move there. What's important, I think, in this debate is not so much the companies going to Bermuda, but this ability to create, to turn profits in the U.S. into deductions.
The Barbados trick.
The Barbados connection, which then rewards you for extracting your capital from the U.S. and deploying it elsewhere where you can replace $10 an hour workers with 25 cent an hour workers,
mm-hmm.
and where you are able to operate in a very low tax or little taxed environment.
Peter Bombusch, then, in all this, we realize we've got global competition going on here. We have shareholders with expectations. Where does a company's obligation to the nation that supported its birth and still supports so much of its activity come in?
Before I do that, I'd like to give you one more triangle, or I feel I'd be inadequate. And that is,
we don't want you feeling inadequate.
All right.
Peter.
The top of the triangle I gave you before was a U.S. company, meaning that the Irish dividends would have to run through it to get up to the shareholders,
mm-hmm.
and therefore would be taxed ultimately at a higher rate than they would if that was not a U.S. company. So the basic transaction, the inversion transaction, involves substituting for that parent U.S. company, a Bermuda company. Right? The effect of that is the U.S. income gets taxed the way it always has been at 35%,
mm-hmm.
but the Irish income is now only taxed at 20% because it never has to go through the U.S. tax ringer at the top.
So you're saying that, in fact, if you don't do this, then old taxation laws are putting an unreasonable burden on companies with new international operations.
Exactly correct. Now, what David has said is a separate issue. He has said, well, it's not so much moving the parent company to Bermuda that's such a problem, although others would say that's enough of a problem. But David is saying there are some mechanical ways to take the income that is being earned by the U.S. company and reduce that by having it make certain deductible payments.
We got that picture. Jack Beatty, I want to turn to you here because the picture that's being drawn is that these tax laws date from a period when less U.S. business was done overseas. Now we're in a global world. Why should the profits abroad be taxed in the same way, in a way that leaves U.S. companies non-competitive? They'll continue to pay taxes on U.S. profits, but maybe we should be changing U.S. law so that those profits made overseas don't create an extra burden for American companies. What do you think?
Well, that may be in the offing. The Treasury Department, according to Paul Krugman, is considering doing something like that. I just fear what direction it'll go in. You know, the basic assumption here seems to be that corporations are paying too much taxes. In fact, according to the invaluable Bob McIntyre at Citizens for Tax Justice, for the first time since the early 80s, corporate tax loopholes will actually cost more than companies pay in income taxes in fiscal 2002 and 2003. That's amazing to hear. Last December, they were given a $9 billion in tax relief were given to multi-billion dollar corporations precisely to promote these kinds of tax havens. We are showering benefits on corporations. They are, you know, the 35% effective rate is only paid by fools. Studies have shown that 41 companies actually paid less than zero in income taxes in at least 1 year from 96 to 98. I could go on and on, but all this is well documented, and yet it has not stopped for a whit the trend or the rhetoric that we are overtaxed on the part of corporations when the fact is that the government showers tax breaks on them.
Let's turn to our callers. Anthony's calling from Delant, Florida. Welcome, Anthony. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you tonight?
Real well, thanks.
Good. I just, in listening to you get into this subject. During the 1970s and early 80s, mm-hmm. the United States lost, either through companies closing down or through moving overseas, somewhere between 32 and 38 million industrial jobs.
Okay.
Now, companies moved overseas because they were looking for cheaper labor, but there was another reason why they moved, that being that in the federal tax code, the stipulation then that still exists, that allowed corporations to deduct their foreign expenses from their domestic profits when they did their taxes.
Okay, we got it. Take us to your point, Anthony.
Well, I mean, it seems like that after that happened, after that massive deindustrialization happened, to be getting upset about this now.
The horse is already out of the barn.
Right, yes, exactly.
Well, what about that? David K. Johnston, and thank you for your call, Anthony. David K. Johnston, what about it? Is this...
Well, I wasn't covering taxes in the 70s. I was writing about other things when I was doing investigative reporting in those days. But the we've had a long-time tax policy that has rewarded companies once they have removed their capital from the U.S. and encouraged them to not expatriate it. That has a significant impact, mm-hmm. in addition to the difference in labor costs. I think the more important question is, can companies do this? The companies are arguing that they have an absolute right to do this. The chairman of Stanley Works says it's not only legal to do this, but it's ethical. How come they weren't doing this even though they've had the opportunity for 20 years? Because prior to the current administration and the current environment in Congress, if companies had sought to do this, mm-hmm. they were likely to be challenged. In fact, Helen of Troy was challenged.
Challenged by the Justice Department, the SEC?
Helen of Troy was challenged by the Internal Revenue Service on this move. In addition, Congress, in fact, there was a briefing held recently for members of the Ways and Means Committee where they raised this question, and they were told by both Republican and Democratic advisors in tax, mm-hmm. that if companies had tried this move, a large numbers of them, and big companies in the past, mm-hmm. everybody's advice and expectation was Congress would immediately shut down the loophole and say, you can't do this.
So why isn't that happening?
Because I think the clear political environment in this country is the president was elected on a platform of tax relief for the rich and tax relief for large corporations. 43% of the benefits on the individual level of his tax plan go to the top 1%.
But is closing tax loopholes the same as taxing people?
No, but the argument that's being put forward is that this is not a loophole. There are those who argue it is. It's that Congress laid out a roadmap to do this, and we're simply taking advantage of that roadmap.
I want to turn to Grover Norquist. He joins us now from Washington. Grover Norquist is president of Americans for Tax Reform. He's a conservative anti-tax activist and Republican Party strategist, influential with the Bush administration. Good evening and welcome, Grover Norquist.
Glad to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Grover Norquist, what's your view of this whole flap over U.S. companies ducking U.S. taxes offshore? Is this necessary for U.S. companies to be competitive? Is there something wrong with our tax policy, or are U.S. companies being unpatriotic?
Well, I think it's very important that you want states to compete with each other to provide the best government at the lowest cost. You want national governments to compete with each other to provide the best government at the lowest cost. It's exactly what we expect and demand of the private sector. We don't allow, you know, McDonald's to say you're not allowed to go to Burger King.
But Bermuda has far lower costs to sustain itself than the United States and a far smaller market, if that's what we're talking about.
Well, one of the things you're looking at is the U.S. government has this worldwide income tax structure that discriminates against American companies. I think if we went to a territorial tax structure where American taxed money earned in America the way France taxes money earned in France, you'd avoid some of these problems as well.
If this loophole is closed, as some Democrats in Washington would now like to do, they've been blocked today by Republicans. But if it should be closed, would that be seen by Republican backers of President Bush as a tax hike?
Well, certainly if you raise taxes, it is a tax hike.
Is closing loopholes a tax, raising taxes?
Anything that increases the revenue to the government is a tax increase. So, you know, when you take a deduction or a credit or you raise rates or you tax income that wasn't taxed before, that certainly is a tax increase. It would be a tax increase. And look, one of the things that big government statists don't like is that one of the disciplines that taxpayers, individuals, businesses, and investors impose on governments is the ability to leave. You saw this in Rhodesia. You saw this in South Africa. You mistreat your citizens, they leave. That's why they're always trying to put exit taxes on people and companies that flee from countries that don't treat them.
But is the United States abusing its citizens and its corporations in such a way that, given all the benefits of having done and now doing business here, they ought to be leaving?
Well, that's a decision, obviously, companies and individuals make, and investors. There are a lot of people in Europe who invest in the United States. They move their money out of Europe to the United States because it's, in certain ways, a lower-tax jurisdiction.
I want to bring in Jack Beatty. It's also a decision that Americans make. There's law involved here. Jack Beatty, what do you think of Grover Norquist's analysis?
Well, you know, one of the main props of corporate law is the notion that the corporation is a person. This comes down from Justice Marshall, and it comes down through other cases in the late 19th century, that the corporation is a person and that it has the same rights that a person has. And under this doctrine, labor unions and government regulation of corporations were regularly pushed down as interfering in the rights of this person, the corporation. But unfortunately, like real persons, we're rooted. We can go someplace else. We still have to pay taxes. But this ghostly person, as Chief Justice Marshall called it, this immortal being, the corporation, it can go. It's ethereal. It can say, well, we're in this mail drop in Bermuda, so we'll pay taxes this way. And it's part of the strange. And on the one hand, it gets this protection. It's a person. But on the other hand, it has these things. It does these things that real persons can't do. So it's a person plus is what a corporation is. And that has been one of the distinguishing features of American corporate law for a long time. And I think this is just the latest expression of that logic.
Grover Norquist, do you see any chance in Washington that this is going to be changed? Are Republicans pretty well in charge on this issue?
Well, I think we need to, again, we want governments to compete with each other to provide the best government at the lowest cost, and it should be easy for people to move from California to Florida if taxes suggest that, and the same thing between countries. It is good to have this kind of competition, and monopolies don't like competition, and governments tend not to like competition, and Burger King hates it when you go to McDonald's, but that's just the way it is.
Peter Bombusch, a last word from you. Are nations now Burger Kings and McDonald's? Does it make sense to you?
I don't believe anyone thinks that. I just think that people are trying to look at what is a fair system of international taxation. They wonder why it is that, in my example, their Irish income should be subject to U.S. tax. And I would quote a famous New Yorker who once said, there is not even a patriotic duty to increase one's taxes. That was Judge Leonard Hand. I think that people are following the tax system. If Congress should decide to change it, fine. But I think it's a little unfair to suggest that people who are doing what is certainly legal today and could be changed
are not patriots.
Patriots.
Peter Bombusch, we've got to take a break. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about U.S. companies ducking U.S. taxes offshore. Is an American corporation that moves its tax address to Bermuda mooching off the nation, or just doing what a good response to the market requires? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guests are David K. Johnston, reporter for the New York Times, who's been following this story, the migration of companies overseas to Bermuda in particular, and Grover Norquist, president of Americans for Tax Reform. Tighe is on the line. Welcome, Tighe. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It seems to me that some of the smartest people in business that I've met include tax attorneys and tax lawyers, tax accountants. And it's somewhat unfortunate that most of their effort, very bright people, is involved in beating the system. Now, not to minimize their work, it's very important and has big implications for corporations, but it's not actually productive in the sense of bettering the cause of mankind. So that would be my first point. What a shame to have such bright people trying to spend all their energies and time just beating the system. And the second thing is the whole Enron debacle. I reckon a lot of that might be attributed to overly complicated taxation rules where you have equally smart people, again, trying to beat the system. Anytime there's new legislation, smart people spend their time trying to circumvent that, create paper entities and tax entities and whatnot to offshore financing. And
point taken, Tug. We know Enron had something like 880 offshore subsidiaries. Thanks for your call. David K. Johnston, what maybe these mines are, as I think Grover Norquist would have it, finding efficiency, finding the most the best spot in the market to pursue their business, and that's all to the good. What do you think?
Well, I don't make judgments about what's good or not. I mean, I make judgments about what I think I ought to go dig up and tell you about that you don't know. And I think since all of us pay taxes, when someone finds a way to minimize or reduce taxes and to actually get a tax break for extracting capital out of the country, that's an issue that people ought to debate and ought to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
After all, the reason we have this fabulous, free, wealthy society is the government of the United States of America. And frankly, I'm astonished that Grover compares the greatest idea in the history of civilization to McDonald's. This is not a business. It is a civilization that we're talking about. And, you know, Robert Morgenthau said in the when he was Treasury Secretary, you know, some people want civilization on the discount.
Grover Norquist, what about it? Are these companies trying to get civilization on the discount? Is there no obligation to the soil from which they grew?
Well, what we're talking about here, the idea that somehow, you know, paying a lot of money to a government, monopolies that do or don't work is somehow paying for civilization. I'm not quite sure how farm subsidies are part of civilization.
Well, let's take education, road systems, airports, inoculations, you know, civil defense, national defense. There's a pretty big list.
Yeah, absolutely. And national defense is 3% of gross national product. The government is 33% of gross national product. About 1/10 to 1/11 of total government spending is national defense.
But with respect, you seem to kind of duck the issue. Isn't there an awful lot that these companies have benefited from by growing up in the United States that they appear to be walking away from here?
Look, what we want in a tax code is an ability to raise the money necessary to run the legitimate functions of government, and our government, as many governments, has gotten too big. And the only discipline on that is people's ability to say, enough, I leave. It's what signals, I'm sorry, the guy who thinks that comparing the United States government to a competent business is critical, is unfair. I think the U.S. government should hope to become as efficient and offer as many choices and opportunities as the private sector does. They should strive to be more like the private sector in providing real services.
But when these companies leave, they don't really leave. They just set up a post office box in Bermuda. They keep doing business in the United States and making money in the
U.S.
And
as you know, they will continue to pay taxes on the income they earn in the United States. They will not pay taxes on the income they earn in Ireland or France.
Mm-hmm.
What does the U.S. government do for your business in Ireland?
Well, I guess it gives me a base from which to launch that business. But that is the question: is that worldwide income?
And the company is now moving to another place to do that.
Mm. Kevin's on the line. Welcome, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hello. Yes. There's one thing I think it's very important. There's this kind of ideology that somehow competition, worldwide competition, is quote unquote good, and that, for example, one of your guests mentioned double taxation as a problem. I would say double taxation is the solution that we should maintain.
Yeah, well, now, that's hardly a Grover Norquist line. What do you mean there,
Here
Kevin?
It is. There was, an earlier guest mentioned about a company that could invest, let's say a particular company invests in the United States a certain amount of money and pays 35% on its profits.
All right.
Now, if it goes to Ireland, it pays 20% there and then 35% here.
Mm-hmm.
You know what that is? That's double taxation. You know what that also is? An incredible incentive to invest in the United States as opposed to elsewhere. That if we, and there was one that was mentioned there about the possibility of eliminating that double taxation. If we eliminated double taxation, I know taxation sounds like a, you know, negative connotation, but in this case, it's an incredible incentive to invest in America and maintain American jobs as opposed to exporting capital. If we eliminated that double taxation, you would have a massive incentive. I don't believe in, you know, greed or patriotism. We've got to structure things in such a way that companies make their profits in meeting our needs.
Kevin, thanks for your call. David K. Johnston, yet it is a global market that companies are competing in. Tell us about the insurance companies. They were some of the first companies to go to Bermuda. It's not just taxes they're getting away from, is it? It's also regulation. For example, even the amount of money that they have to hold in reserve to pay claims?
That's correct. Now, of course, the Bermudans would tell you that they have a full-blown regulatory system. What they have is a system that says if you have enough money there, in your opinion, to cover the claims, you can cover the claims. One of the things that companies would like to do is to get out of the U.S. tax and regulatory system, not by getting Americans to agree in our political process to change the system, but by finding some way to get out through a loophole or a secondary way, not through the political process.
Is it true that if they set up shop in Bermuda, or the mailbox at least, that they're immune to judgments against them in U.S. courts, that they're somehow less accountable to shareholders in the U.S.?
Well, immune is a little strong, but the law in Bermuda is dramatically different, despite a number of companies saying it's minor, from the U.S. In the United States, directors and officers of a company have a fiduciary duty, that is, a duty of loyalty to the shareholders of the company, the people who own the company. In Bermuda, they only owe that duty to the company. They are allowed, therefore, to engage in what's called self-dealing with the company. And so long as they can show that they were prudent and they didn't amount to fraud, which is a very high level to reach, they can engage in self-dealing with the company. There are critics who would argue that they can basically loot the company. It certainly does not help the fundamental problem that has been addressed for a long time in the U.S. in various ways with various degrees of success, that's called the agency problem, where the executives of the company have an incentive to run it for their benefit rather than the benefit of the shareholders.
Dave is on the line. Welcome, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi. I've been interested in hearing a lot of these comments about the system and what the problems are. It seems to me that when we talk about the problems of U.S. international taxation, originally the system was set up to capture income in these other countries because U.S. companies were just trying to not bring their income earned abroad home. And that was the purpose of these rules.
Mm-hmm.
What's happened is in the last several years, Congress has just gone wild in making these rules so much more overly broad so that they capture all kinds of income that's earned abroad. It's not just a question of trying to defer income, but more getting it really is a form of double taxation. And I find it kind of ironic now that you see this whole movement in Congress about trying to shut down this big loophole. But really, it comes from the fact that Congress continues to overly complicate the code and create broader and broader tax laws that I think are making it difficult for U.S. companies to be competitive abroad.
Well, we got it, Dave. Jack Beatty, let me put that to you. Are you open to the notion, Jack, that perhaps there are problems in the tax code here that do handicap U.S. companies in international competition? Does it have to be so black and white?
I don't know. I really don't know. All I know is that U.S. corporate tax payments are now 1.4% of GDP, which is the third lowest level in 60 years. So it's hard to make a case just on those numbers that there's an undue tax burden on U.S. corporations, whether through their own production here or through the foreign connection. But, you know, I think what Grover just showed us is kind of the imagination, really, I think, in part of this administration, that the country exists for the sake of capitalism, that the country exists for the sake of the market, rather than the other way around. What is he putting first? He's putting the market first. The country is second. And I just think this is a kind of economism. You know, you just follow it to its logical conclusion and you make every decision based upon what the ledger says that day. But that isn't the way countries function.
What do you fear is the outcome of that logical chain, Jack?
Well, it's a kind of anarchy, you know. It's a kind of devil take the hindmost. It's, you know, subordinating all issues just to what the market says. And that has led to the crack of civilizations in the past, and it could do for this one, too. George Soros, no Bolshevik, has said that, you know, the great threat to capitalism today is this market idea, is the excess of it, is the notion that everything comes down to the market.
Grover Norquist, how about it? Jack Beatty is suggesting that your view of the world leads to anarchy and a cracked civilization. Where do you think that the market framework ultimately leads?
Freedom. When he uses the word capitalism, substitute what Jefferson would call it, liberty. The idea that people should be free to lead their lives as they see fit. They want to write books. They want to give speeches. They want to produce widgets. Capitalism is simply a word for freedom. The idea of the marketplace is simply the area where people's exchanges and decisions and interactions are based on voluntary exchanges. When you go to the post office, you're dealing with a monopoly. When you deal with the private sector, you're dealing with voluntary exchanges. When the IRS comes and takes money from you, that is not a voluntary exchange. When you buy something or sell something in the market, that's a voluntary exchange. We would like, as Americans, starting with Washington and Jefferson and all the founders, to have as much decision made in a free society through voluntary means, and as few decisions made with a guy holding a gun on you saying, give me your Social Security taxes, give me your income taxes, or I'll let you have it. So this is a debate on whether you're for liberty or not. And, of course, some people don't like liberty. We've just had a huge discussion of that with the Soviet Union, and they lost.
David K. Johnston, do you see it really breaking down along these ideological lines, or is there something in the middle that people might cotton to as a reasonable perspective on the issues on the table here?
No, actually, I think that your selection of Jack Beatty, who is doing a book about the role of corporations in American history, as I understand it, and Grover, who is the strategist for the people in Congress who in the last 5 years have immensely complicated the tax code and handed out all sorts of favors to their political donors, have present very much the argument that's going on here. There is a notion that's gaining a lot of currency in this country that government is bad, that you want to have a competitive market, and that's all that matters, and that the market comes first, not the idea of America. This is a profoundly radical idea that is gaining a lot of currency because people don't go back to fundamental principles about why we created this country and the notion that we will govern ourselves and find solutions. It instead argues, well, if you can find a way out of any rule, then you're entitled to do that. You have no sense of responsibility except to meet the minimum standard rule the country has, and if you can get your friends in Congress to create rules that allow you to get out of obligations but other people can't, good for you. That's what you can do in a competitive market.
It makes those little mailboxes in Bermuda look like a pretty important battle line.
I think that they are an important battle line, and that is not arguing that we should have higher or lower taxes. I mean, anyone who has read my coverage in the New York Times knows that there are serious problems with the tax system in this country.
David K. Johnston, we'll come back to that, but we thank you for being with us tonight. David K. Johnston is a reporter for the New York Times. Grover Norquist, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Grover Norquist is president of Americans for Tax Reform and a confidant of many in the Republican Party. Jack Beatty, thanks for your fire this hour.
Thank you.
Ready, aim, fire. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WB.